services to Oregonians all over the state, and we're going to hear from a couple of the managers from those organizations today. So let me call Jeff Hetherington, Ruby Houghton, and Dean and Greta to the witness stand, please. Enter and sign in.
We hope it continues to look that way, but we do have some organization today.
Jeff, if you can talk right into the microphone, because as storied as this room is, the acoustics and sound system aren't as good as some of the... That's a technical term. We have an electrical engineer in the audience, so he understands that. They're not as good as some of the new hearing rooms.
For the record, my name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm the president of Family Care Incorporated. We are one of the fully capitated health plans, which contracts with the state of Oregon to provide care to the Oregon health plan population. I'm also here in a capacity as chairman of the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon, which is actually the group of all 13 fully capitated health plans that provide services around the state of Oregon. I'd like to give you a little bit of a history lesson, and I'll move through this rather quickly, but we think it's important for the committee to understand that there has been a private sector delivery system in Oregon for a long time. And it's morphed, it's changed, but we've actually seen this part delivery, sometimes full delivery, from the private sector since 1975. It began with contracts that the state had with Kaiser Permanente back in 1975, and in 1983, and that's a typo on my part, House Bill 3013 was enacted, which allowed for physician care organizations to sign risk contracts for physician services only, and then to basically guarantee and manage care to the Medicaid population. That first got started in the Tri-County area about two years later. Multnomah County Clinics, Emanuel Hospital, the OHSU clinics, and Family Care were the first players in that market. It then expanded, and I probably have left a few off here, but down into Marion County, Polk County, Jackson and Josephine counties. So the PCO movement of providing management for, at least at the physician level, for care for the Medicaid population was spread out over a larger sector by the time we got to the Oregon Health Plan. Now, the Oregon Health Plan was started in 1994, mandated that anybody who wanted to, in the private sector, who wanted to play the game had to become a fully capitated health plan, and that basically meant that we had to live and breathe and act like an HMO. So we were at risk, and I've listed the services here, not only for physician services, but hospitals, prescription drugs, DME, nursing homes, skilled nursing facilities, the whole ball of wax that you would get in a commercial package.
Jeff, let me interrupt you for just a second.
Thank you, Chair. Rick, Jeff, could you differentiate, do I understand that technically we call them fully capitated health plans because they don't fit federal HMO, and is there any difference?
Yes, let me talk about that. Thank you. The fully capitated health plan, which was set up under Senate Bill 27, and just like the PCOs that were set up under House Bill 3013, did not have to have insurance licenses through DCBS. So there were some groups who actually did have insurance license, like Regents Blue Cross and the Good Health Plan and Kaiser. And then there were the fully capitated health plans who fell under that definition only were basically collections, and we're going to talk about how they're organized a little later here in the testimony, of mostly physician organizations who came together formed an organization to provide care in their own local service areas. And let me get into that. That's a part of my next presentation here. So in 1994, this was the first time we saw the commercial insurers come into the market in terms of Medicaid managed care besides Kaiser. And that included Regents Blue Cross, Good Health Plan, ODS, Pacific Care, and QualMed. In 2000, basically what happened is the commercial carriers exited the market. The only people that were left over at that time was Kaiser and the Good Health Plan / Providence hospitals. And they downsized the number of clients that they were taking. The non-commercial insurance type FCHPs and the local IPAs basically absorbed that market. And how that happened was Care Oregon, which is the largest plan in Oregon, took over a large number of Blue Cross people in the Portland area. The Lane County IPA took over the care of the people in Eugene. In Salem, the Mid Valley IPA took over that population. So you had a lot of scrambling among organizations that were pretty much local to fill the gap when the commercial carriers moved out. And then some of us who had been around also picked up some of those clients. In 2001, OHP2 was created through legislation, and in 2003, starting on February 1st, OHP2 has been implemented, and that, of course, brings into a two-tiered benefit package with your plus population, which is your categorical eligibles, and your standard population, which are what used to be called the new eligibles. And the reason I bring this up, because it does impact on private sector management of Medicaid, because as of March 1, when the drug benefit goes away, most of your managed care delivery system will exit from the standard population. And the reason why in short form here, before we get into other areas, is that it's hard to manage chronically ill people without drugs, and the physicians, frankly, have told us, you know, our physicians, our network physicians, say we won't do it. And that and the fact that the risk factor is too high, and I'll let Dean Andretta talk about that later because he knows the numbers far better than I do. The one of the questions
we've... Representative Bates.
Thank you. I had a question as you went along I thought you might get to. You kind of gave a synopsis here. Why have some of the plans left and others stayed on board? You mentioned several have left the arena, commercial plans primarily. Why have some plans managed to stay above water on this thing and others have decided to leave?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bates, what you will get is my opinion, and it would be wise to ask some of the commercial carriers, you know, to either refute or accept that opinion. But our answer to that is this. The commercial carriers are basically set up to take care of the commercial population, the standard average population out there in the public. The Medicaid population has special needs that the commercial carriers are not set up to address. The fully capitated health plans who we represent, I mean, we were basically formed to take care of the Medicaid population. We have developed different organizational structures in terms of you know, who we hire and what we hire them to do. We have different payment methodologies, and we know how to handle this this population. It's a niche market, and what the commercial carriers, I think, will say to you is they didn't know how to do it other than the way they do it with the commercial, and they lost too much money doing it that way.
Follow up. So I assume then there was no adverse selection and there was no significant difference in capitation rates for these people.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, there was no difference in the capitation rates among the capitated health plans except for geographical differences, which applied to all of us. And in terms of adverse risk selection, I couldn't answer that, you know, factually, but I would say I don't believe that there really was a huge difference in selection.
Thank you.
Just a second, Jeff.
Rick? Jeff, you had mentioned, thank you, Chair, that as of March 1st, carriers will be pulling off the OHP standard.
Correct.
It's like notice been given. Is there a 30-day rule? Do you know exactly who will be, and has that been formalized in terms of them terminating as of that date, or is it right now just plans moving in that direction? Jennifer here
and Mr. Rakobian. I will tell you that that I was just informed before this meeting by Dean that that we finally got what the rates would look like on March 1. We got them sometime today. That they reflect about a 10% increase in utilization of hospital services and physician services. Our projections, the best that we know, would be more like an 85%. I can tell you for a fact that family care will pull out. I won't speak for any other plans because I haven't had time to pull them. But most of the people I've talked to said that if they stay in, they'll probably stay in for 1 or 2 months, basically to try and reorganize their staff down, because we'll all lose about 25% of our clientele. And, you know, there's some dislocation of our own personnel when you do that.
For the standard population.
For the standard population only. We'll stay in for the plus.
Right.
I mean, that's not an issue.
Seems we had that discussion here not very long ago. Representative Cruz.
Well, and even without the tail on standard, could still eat you alive, but that's another issue. could you give me a little historical thing? Why did SureCare fail? Well, I mean, you know the story,
Chair Representative Cruz, let me tell you what I know.
Okay.
This may not be the whole story.
By the way, SureCare was a Douglas County IPA.
This is what I heard was that they had a successful organization going into Douglas County. They decided to expand, and one of their areas of expansion was Lincoln County. And that turned out to be a big mistake for them because they found out that the rates were not sufficient in Lincoln County to cover the cost. And I will tell you that I had the same experience with family care in Jackson County. We operated very successfully for almost 10 years in Jackson County. And then we decided to take 100% of the enrollment. And within 8 months, I had lost $1.8 million in that county. So it was pretty much a factor of... I'll speak for myself, and I think it applies to SureCare. We didn't do all of our homework on what the real costs were, and we got caught. And I think that's what happened to SureCare also.
Okay, I guess when I after when SureCare went into Lincoln County, that was really the only Oregon health plan that was going to be there.
Right.
And so without that, nothing existed. I don't know all the details, but I did hear that the state was not incredibly helpful in finding innovative ways to help them actually exist there. What do you know about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, not much, but okay. I can tell you how it's set up for us as capitated health plans, because I could make that case about Jackson County, but it wouldn't be true. The way it's set up in terms of the way the risk is figured and the way rates are set, they've got five distinct geographical areas. And unless the state decided to start carving up counties and rating them individually, there's not much that they could do. Because there are some counties, frankly, where the same illness is going to cost you a lot more than in others. I hope it wasn't something I said.
Thanks for coming.
Well, and thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the fact is I watched that kind of from the outside and watched something that was working very well, and they may have overstepped themselves, and I think one of the lessons learned there was that docs aren't the best businessmen in the world, but the fact was that they were trying to serve a part of the state that was being unserved and went under because of that. And
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I will say that a number of us have had that experience by going into certain areas, and you know we pulled out of other areas, and you've seen that a lot over the last 7 years.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff, you've hit on a point that may be important for us later in our discussions, and that is the difference in cost in different geographical areas. And I've never got a good handle on what the difference is. Are we talking 4 or 5 percentage points, or are we talking 20 or 30% differences for providing health care in certain areas?
I think that you could get as much as 10 to 15% swing in what I would call the geographical cap areas. And I'll give you an example for this, and that is that the other counties, you've got the distinct areas are Lynn Benton, Marion Polk, the Portland Tri-County area, Jackson, Josephine, and Douglas, and then all other. And the problem with the, for instance, with the all other is that that includes Bend and St. Charles, which is a large hospital, pretty stable you know, population, large catchment area, and the experience you have there is figured into a county like Baker County, where they have, you know, shortage of doctors, they've got little hospitals they're trying to support, and when you try to balance that and blend it in, you don't have enough money in some of the smaller counties to really support the system that's there. And that's probably the best I can do with that explanation. Without drawing pictures.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We could turn in our hymnals to page two.
We're moving right along.
There's been some questions about, well, what is managed care? What do the fully capitated health plans do? And so I made a list here. And, what we're talking about, we don't like the term managed care, but it seems like that's the one that sticks here. But what we really provide as fully capitated health plans is care management to this population. And what I tried to do was differentiate on this page the difference between what we do and what happens for just a client who's on fee for service. So this is the kind of services that we are required under our contract to deliver. And, you know, number one up at the top of the list is we have to organize the delivery system in every area that we operate in. And that means that we have to find the physicians who agree to see this population. We have to contract with them. We have to do the same with the hospitals, although the hospitals are pretty easy to find. We have to do that with all the ancillary services, with the pharmacies, with the nursing homes. Anything we need, we have to have an organized delivery system so that we can make sure that we have access for these clients. And that means if you're in a rural county, you also have to go into the big urban areas to get the tertiary care hospitals lined up also. The second thing we do is we ensure access. We have very specific requirements about how long a client has to wait to get in to see a physician. Now, I'm not talking about a hospital. I'm talking about a physician, a primary care physician, and then a specialist. So we have to ensure when we organize the network that there's, you know, that there's that willingness on the part of the doctors to see them and see them in a timely manner that speaks to not only their needs but, you know, what the contract says. We provide a lot of support services to the clients and the providers. And this is an important thing if you talk to the doctors out in the field. You know, this is not an easy population to care for. And the fact that they have a managed care plan that they can fall back on means a lot to them. So we provide information services both to the physician in terms of, you know, what's out there for a particular client. We provide it to the clients in terms of, you know, where they want to go to get not only their drugs, because they do need this kind of information and they forget from time to time, where to find the doctors, when it's appropriate to go to ERs, and all of that. We do case management services for the people who have chronic care needs. We do coordination of mental health services, coordination of care among providers. You get sometimes when the best phrase I ever heard was, you know, that was a medical education program called Overdosing Grandma, and they were talking about how you know, the older folk tend to go to three and four providers. Well, you know, we find that quickly, you know, and winnow it down, because sometimes they don't know that they're going to three or four providers, and this doctor's doing that, and this doctor's doing something else. And we do provide language and transportation services. We have an ongoing educational service we have to provide to clients and to the providers in terms of how the system is used, chronic disease care, cultural competencies, which is a big deal with a lot of clients. And then we're required to implement prevention strategies. Number one on the list is prenatal care. We go out and find them. When they are pregnant, we get them on the phone, and we get them to a doctor, and we get them into prenatal care quick. We do the same thing with diabetes management, smoking cessation, immunizations, and lead screening. Now, this is a picture. If you wanted to come to our offices, you'd be amazed. Sit in our member services department, sit in our health services area, and just listen to the kinds of questions we field. Yes.
Rick. Thank you, Chair. Jeff, do you evaluate your services, and if you do, how? And then is there a way to actually kind of compare on that same level, I guess, the quality of services between the different plans around the state? Is that even doable?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Prokopian, the answer to your question is yes, and we all do. We have actually, I think, two different levels of evaluation. One is the state has their own evaluation monitors that they come in and check. So we have that. I can tell you what Family Care does on a biannual basis is we have both member surveys that go out to the clients and physician surveys. Our board has been very clear that we need a 90% satisfaction rate among our providers and 80% satisfaction rate among our clients. And we ask them questions about access, you know, ease of getting into a doctor's office, you know, whether or not they were treated properly. We talk to the providers about, you know, do you feel like your bills are getting paid? I mean, we may feel like it, but we ask all those questions from a customer service standpoint to make sure that we can keep the system together. You have to do that with this population, and the reason is, particularly with on the physician side, is if the doctors aren't happy and they're not being paid in a timely manner and at least, you know, at a level where they feel they're not getting killed, they'll all go away. So, you know, this whole customer service thing is pretty important to us. And I think that would be duplicated across every single plan.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the fee-for-service side, we're seeing an exodus of providers from the system. Many of these patients can't find a provider anymore, so there's really no access for them, especially in Jackson County. I think it's across the state. Are you having trouble holding on to your providers, or are they staying in the system with you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I think most of us would say we're nervous about holding on to our providers. As long as we can maintain our current level of reimbursement, they'll grumble. But they'll stay in the system. But most of us, to our primary care providers, and I'll be corrected if I'm wrong here by other plans, we're probably paying a good 20% to 30% above OMAP for primary care services, and probably about 10% to 12%, maybe 15% above for specialty services. So that's part of how we keep them in. But there's a lot of grumbling, and there is actually some. I would say some limitations now on the numbers that we can feed into these physicians because, you know, there are other cost factors out there that are basically driving them to take the commercial market more heavily than they used to. And that, you know, that's Medicare in addition to, you know, the Medicaid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification, I'd like to talk to you about capitation for a moment just so we all get on the same page. The plans are capitated, but I don't believe the physicians are capitated. The providers are probably not individually capitated. So you're trying to hold down hospitalization rates. You're trying to control pharmacy costs. You're trying to control utilization, I assume. And since the physicians themselves aren't capitated, they're not at risk. How have you managed to do that inside managed care plans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, actually, and I can't give you the exact number of plans who have capitation contracts for a physician. And for those of you who are unfamiliar, capitation means instead of paying them for each service they provide, we assign them a number of clients, panel of clients, and then we pay them per head per month. Family Care is probably the most heavily capitated of all the plans. All of our primary care physicians are capitated. A number of our specialists are capitated, and one of our hospitals is capitated, so they are assuming risk. I know that a number of other plans do have capitation arrangements with their primary cares. I think we're the only ones that have hospitals and specialists. And then there are some plans that are full fee-for-service. And that's the lay of the land that I'm giving.
But at the same time, you know there are some plans that where the physicians are not capitated.
Correct.
I mean, you're talking a lot of case management there. So what's the difference between what you do and a disease management plan? Or is there? Or do we need to not stray into that at this point in time?
I would, Representative Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, I prefer not to stray there and direct you to Dr. Baines for that answer.
It's a good question, though.
I'm actually not a physician or a nurse, and I'd have to defer to one of them to give you a good
I mean, one of the things I think worth considering is moving from the traditional managed care to more of a disease management type model, and I'm not sure what the difference is. So,
well, if in a disease management type model, you take diabetes, if you're and just manage that disease in a case management kind of situation, you would take a patient who has multiple needs beyond just one particular disease, and they might need have nursing home needs, they might have DME needs, they might have all sorts of in addition to their diabetes. So the case becomes bigger than just the single entity, if that makes sense to you. And I'll give you a quick example about case management. We got notified of a woman who was pregnant up in Pendleton. And in our case management of prenatal care, we found out through the doctor that she was actually living in a tent on the Columbia River. So from our point of view, and I think any plan would do this, we started trying to find out where we could get her housing services. She happened to be have some Indian rights. We couldn't get the tribe to move. We couldn't get, various and sundry agencies to move. We ended up renting her an apartment in Pendleton for the last 6 months of her pregnancy so that we could ensure that she had decent health and hopefully would deliver twins is what she had, in such a time that we wouldn't have two bad babies. Now, that's in my mind, that's full case management. You look out for that whole thing. But if it hadn't been for a managed care plan doing that, which any one of us would do because it's not only good medicine, it's good business, she would have fallen through the cracks and, been out there in a tent because there were no state agencies that we could find to help, or federal in that particular case. I would like to just call your attention on page 3 here. What I have done is list all of the managed care plans. And you'll see across, I've indicated who they are, their home base, where their corporate office is, the communities they serve, the kind of business that they are, and there are basically three. You have nonprofits. You have two nonprofits, which is Care Oregon and Family Care. You have a number which are physician-owned and then physician-hospital-owned. The two other presenters are going to talk about those. When they were founded, when they started their own Medicaid contract date. Now, some of them used to be contracting with, for instance, with Regents Blue Cross, but this is when they started being at risk on their own. How many Medicaid enrollees they have, and then if they have other lines of business. A number of the IPAs, independent physician organizations, do have contracts with commercial insurers to manage care for their products also. And with that, I will turn it over to Ruby Houghton, unless there are any other questions.
Thank you. Ruby?
Chair Westland, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ruby Houghton. I'm the Legislative and Public Affairs Director for Care Oregon. We are a not-for-profit Oregon business. In the packet that you have in front of you, I'm going to give you, rather than spending a lot of time on Care Oregon particulars, I think I've shared this with many of you, I'm going to give you just a brief bit of information about our organization that might be slightly different from the other organizations here. We were founded as a collaborative.
Ruby, hold on. Heather.
Sure.
Do you guys hear all right in the back?
Oh, I'm sorry. Here we go.
Boy, that's the first time that's ever happened to you, isn't it?
We can make this work. You were enjoying it? Oh, my goodness.
Jeff, you're a bad boy.
We were founded as a collaborative. Can you hear me now? Part of the 2000, what is it? Part of the 2002 discussion. Can you hear me now?
formed as a collaborative in 93 by a public and private sector. So Oregon Health Sciences University, Multnomah County, and the Oregon Primary Care Association. And I want to pause a minute just to tell you about those organizations and why they formed Care Oregon. We were formed solely for the purpose of receiving the Oregon Health Plan population as a fully capitated health plan. And in doing so, our parent collaborators made sure that the building blocks of Care Oregon were based on caring for that population. We knew the population already. The Oregon Primary Care Association is the safety net, the healthcare safety net. Oregon Health Sciences University participated in caring for this population already, as did Multnomah County Health Department through their primary care clinics. So when Jeff talks about the other plans as they formed, as we have evolved, as Care Oregon has evolved, we have added private docs and the IPA environment, but we were actually formed by this collaborative, and the other plans don't have the safety net component to the degree that Care Oregon does, because those were our original partners. I've included in your packet a Care Oregon fact sheet.
Oh. Thank you, Ms. Chair. I don't mean to interrupt that. Could you define a safety net clinic for people?
Absolutely. The safety net clinic population out in throughout the state of Oregon is made up of federally qualified health centers, like the Salem Clinic, the West Salem Clinic, I've got a list of those in your packet, like Multnomah County, and then small clinics like Representative Bates. They were small in the beginning, like the clinics in your district run by Peg Crowley. And throughout the state, there are small clinics, community clinics, not receiving federal dollars, and rural health clinics throughout the state who actually serve as part of the safety net. And so when you hear the word health care safety net, we're talking about the smaller clinics, and throughout the state, those clinics actually provide services to both the insured via Oregon Health Plan and the uninsured, and they are required to serve both.
And if I could interrupt for my knowledge,
the difference between federally qualified and just your regular or non-federally qualified is that the federally qualified get full cost reimbursement and the standard, if you will,
both
whatever traditional reimbursement rates they can get off of whatever covered plan member may happen to be, or not a member, but a patient may happen to be a member of. Is that correct?
Representative Westland, you are correct halfway.
Yep.
Rural health centers also receive those wraparound payments,
okay,
in addition to federally qualified health centers. So they're both receiving those payments. And those are the federally qualified rural health centers.
But there are clinics that don't.
That do not receive those. And those are the small, some of them are community clinics, community health clinics. Some are formed by little groups and associations. But they raise their money generally from the community. And I think that's the case with your clinic, your two clinics.
Grants, donations, yeah.
Right.
Representative Bates.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So if we find a situation where we have to disenroll people from OHP, how robust is the safety net clinic? I mean, what we're looking at is, has possibly a significant number coming off, going to emergency rooms or going to safety net clinics. You would feel some of that burden also, I would expect.
Representative Bates, Chair Westland, the safety net is at capacity today as we speak. And so many of those clinics are busting at the seam. With our unemployment rate being what it is, and with individuals going on and off the Oregon Health Plan, they don't leave the clinic. And so those clinics maintain that population for the duration. And so what we're finding is they have high numbers of people coming in, and their doctors are getting tired, and their nurses and the rest of their staff. We would like to expand the safety net, and I'm sure that someone will be in to talk with you about that on another occasion. But certainly the safety net is busting at the seams, and had received some support from the legislature that went unallocated.
And this is a safety net question. Do we know the status of Bush's initiative to increase funding for the safety nets? Is that an area you're familiar with?
Yes. We are waiting and very interested.
We take that as a no.
I never want to give up hope.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure we all have a clear understanding of safety net clinics, because even I have some concern. I'm not always certain what they mean. You offer, for the most part, primary care at the safety net clinics, don't offer subspecialty care, and obviously don't offer hospitalized care for people who are uninsured, I assume.
That's correct.
So the uninsured people would have to get what service they could from you, but if they needed a specialist or they needed hospitalization, then, again, they would be sort of on their own, so to speak.
Pretty much, although the clinics themselves do a very good job of begging and borrowing. And I think that would be the way that they would go at it. If you were in a clinic, in a safety net clinic, I know you'd do that.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. I missed the connection between Care Oregon and the safety net clinics. The safety net clinics are not part of Care Oregon, are they? We're talking about a separate set to catch the people who are not insured, or sometimes you're contracted with them.
Representative Merkley, Chair Westland, yes, we contract with the safety net clinics. They are a part of our panel. So our panel of providers includes some safety net clinics.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So this term, safety net clinics, come about because the state passed a law and said we're going to have a system of safety net clinics and funded the safety net plan of 2001, or is it a term of art that emerged in the industry to catch people as last resort, or what is the short couple sentence history here on
the term nets? Safety net is a coined term. It was here when I got here. And it is a loose structure of clinics throughout the state, and it forms kind of the fabric of what's there to catch people when they are uninsured. And so when we talk about the safety net, if the person doesn't have OHP, they don't have Medicaid, they don't have commercial insurance, there's this kind of loose connection of clinics throughout the state that can catch them in the primary care sort of way to provide a doctor or a nurse so that they don't fall through the cracks.
And are these nonprofits that, say, organized in this town, we're going to make sure we have someone to help out poor and impoverished individuals here?
Yes. Representative Merkley, Chair Westland, they are not-for-profits, or they are part of a county system. And the reason why I say loosely structured, it's because they're all different.
Okay.
Throughout the state, it's a patchwork.
Okay, but we're not talking about emergency rooms.
No.
Which are in some sense the safety net in many.
No, I think places. And I think that's a confusing piece of using the word safety net. I've seen that term used for AAA automobile service.
Mm-hmm.
We're
yeah.
your safety net. And so I think when we use that term, it does cause people some confusion, but it is
okay.
The healthcare clinic safety net.
Thank you very much.
And I like your question. Mm-hmm. I think one of their primary functions is to keep people out of the emergency room, one of their primary benefits. But I want to clarify this. I mean, you have a contractual relationship. Well, okay, with how many?
We have a contractual relationship with probably about 6 different safety net clinics throughout the state.
What about Mike Joy?
There are about 60% of our panel, and
it's
about 50%.
Whoa. Okay.
And Multnomah County has the largest, so I counted them as one.
And so Representative Merkley walks in there, and he's uninsured. That safety net clinic is going to see him under any circumstances.
The clinic itself is going to ask you some questions about your income and ask you for some information. And each clinic has a different...
But they're going to see him.
And they're going to try to see him. Yes, they are.
Okay.
And he may need to pay a fee with his uninsurance, and based on his income, he may need to pay the clinic a fee.
And then Representative March walks in there, and he's an Oregon Health Plan patient.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to see him, and they will be reimbursed a given rate. I mean,
that's correct.
Okay.
How'd you know I chose the Oregon Health Plan?
Tell by the beard.
And just to confuse the matter a bit more, there are rare occasional patients who have regular commercial insurance that do go to the SafeNet clinic, but they are very rare because they're not locked out from it. But and primarily you deal with those people. I would also add that the SafeNet clinics, at least in my area, and I understand across the state, take some of the most difficult patients in the state to take care of. A lot of them have severe mental problems, alcohol and drug problems. They are the hardest to manage and most difficult to manage. And the SafeNet clinics not only are the court of last resort for these people, but they also take care of them. They've really taken on a very difficult group.
Yeah, I don't want to get too far afield on SafeNet, but, I mean, that's part of Care Oregon's panel, if you will. And that's a good, 50%, that's impressive. On top of that, we've got free clinics, but that's a whole different story. Is that a question?
Yes, sure. Thank you. To clarify then, so when you contract with one of these federally qualified health plans or rural health care and it's an OHP client, the reimbursement they get is a full cost reimbursement. You have to build that into your contract with them?
Yes, we do.
Okay. And then others go there might pay a varying fee who aren't OHP that might... To a rural health care center, for example.
Mr. Povin, Chair, yes, that is correct.
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, one of your clinics is Open Door in Douglas County. It's funded through a multitude of sources. They have huge community support both in finances and in services. And, you know, I mean, there's dentists go in there and give free dental and all sorts of things happen there. I guess, so, but the only people that are going there that are in your book of business are the OHP folks?
Representative Cruz, Chair Westland, yes, that's correct.
Okay.
I want to make a distinction here between being on the OHP and being uninsured. Because oftentimes we think that people are insured, you know, the way that we are, that it's a straight line. They've got straight insurance. If your income goes up a bit, you get kicked off OHP. And so what happens in the safety net environment is that person actually has a home. So their income has gone up a bit, but it wasn't enough to purchase commercial insurance. And so what they're doing, you know, once they lose their eligibility for OHP, is they're still going to the clinic, and as Representative Merkley and I just discussed, they're paying a fee for their services. So the clinic is receiving some sort of financial compensation for that individual to continue on in the clinic, even though they've been dropped off of OHP because their income has gone up, but not quite enough to get commercial insurance.
Right, I understand that. It's based on ability to pay, clearly, but from the perspective of Care Oregon, your relationship with Open Door is their OHP clientele only?
Representative Cruz, Chair Westland, that is correct.
Okay.
We are only an Oregon Health Plan contract.
Right. I didn't want any confusion because safety nets go beyond managed care structure. So,
yeah, and we can stay in that for an hour.
Well, I'm slow. I'm sorry.
Thank you for the clarification.
Representative Bates.
One last question, real quick, and I'm out of here. Okay. On this one, have any of the clinics, safety clinics, reached capacity and aren't able to take new patients now, or have a long wait? I mean, where are they at right now?
Representative Bates and Chair Westland. What happens is clinics will actually stop enrolling either OHP or uninsured, depending upon their mix of clients. And so once they reach capacity, they have to say, we aren't taking any more Oregon Health Plan clients, because they have to keep that balance. They are required by law to keep a particular balance between the uninsured and the Medicaid population.
Have any clinics reached that point?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
So then the answer to my earlier question, sparked by Representative Merkley, is no. If someone presents himself, you're not automatically going to take them.
Chair Westland, that is correct. If they have a slot, they will try to take
it. If they have the capacity,
yeah,
they will. But in, I mean, I think where Merkley was going, I was trying to get to, I mean, it's not an emergency room, but there is a capacity issue. I mean, you might get diverted from an emergency room, but you're going to find an emergency room someplace. That's not necessarily true with safety net clinics. Okay.
That is correct. I've provided you with a fact sheet on Care Oregon, and because we've spent so much time on the safety net, perhaps I think it would be a good idea for us to move along a little bit. But I've provided you with some data relative to the population that we are currently serving, and I'd like to call your attention to the next rather colorful sheet that talks about our members. And I thought this might be useful for the committee, because it actually pulls out the population by category. And as you're asking questions about how many people are in the blind disabled category, with Medicare, without Medicare, how many are CHIP children, and so on, it gives you an idea of who are the clients, you know, who are these individuals. And then on the following page, I've broken out for you the Oregon Health Plan standard population and then the plus population, so that you can see how many clients we do have on this February 12th run who are in OHP standard and who are in OHP plus.
Mr. Chair?
And just a second, and this is fairly representative of the split between most or all of the federally capitated plans, that 25%, give or take a little, of the standard population, 75% of the categorical.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the old age here, since I'm, you know, getting closer. I've heard about plans that are not taking, they cut off taking any more Medicare patients. So do you foresee Care Oregon picking up more old age as the baby boomers get older?
Actually, I shouldn't have said that. I whispered into the microphone. I hope not, since I'm, you know, getting there. Representative Mona Sanderson, Chair Westland, we actually can't take on more of the what's called the Medi-Medi population. And so this population actually declines for us. I don't believe that it grows. Since I came to Care Oregon, I believe the numbers have been going down. And these are people who have the dual benefit based on income and other criteria, and we don't take large numbers of these folks.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, if I heard correctly, I think there was an impression that some of the plans are not taking these clients. We have absolutely no ability to pick and choose among the categories. So when we're open for enrollment, we're open for enrollment in all categories, and when we're closed, then we're closed for all categories. And the only place where that changed now is the standard versus the plus. But none of us have the ability to say we're not going to take Medicare, and I'm sort of surprised, you know, that that's the impression you've gotten, that none of us are doing that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And the conversation, Representative Mona Sanderson, was, I should have said, we are closed to enrollment.
for that population. I'm sorry. We've been closed to enrollment and open to enrollment. I forgot to say that we were closed. The next page gives you a breakdown of the different languages that people identify as their first language. And then the next provides you with information on age. And I do want to point out that there's a huge population of children in the OHP plus category between the ages of 1 and 19. And then I also provided you some information sorted by ethnicity and race.
Is the age breakdown, Ruby, going to be fairly consistent with the rest of the plans? Round numbers, I mean, a little higher here, a little lower there. I mean, some of the language, you know, I can't imagine that there's too many people in Bend that whose primary language is Chamorro. What is that?
Mr. Westland, I have no idea. I know the top seven languages,
Indian,
but I do not know all the others.
I think it's Mexican.
It's a dialect of Mexican Indian. Is it?
See, that's why we have the crack staff.
No, really.
We have. All right.
I'm dating one of those right now.
Yeah.
Hey, Jamar.
Oh. Well,
would you like to come to the witness stand and flesh that out a little bit? I mean,
let us smarty pants keep shut.
Yeah.
And
okay, follow that.
I can't. Chair Westland, members of the committee, for your information, I've also included you with some information on the safety net clinics because I thought there were going to be questions, but I thought you might get to that later. Where is that? It's in this next packet, the next stapled packet.
Okay.
And it speaks to the safety net clinic network. As it relates to the Oregon Health Plan population. And then I've also included in the packet for you the Center for Healthcare Strategies working paper regarding managed care best practices. And so I hope that will provide you with adequate reading for the weekend.
Oh, yeah.
These are actually some great charts, Ruby, and excellent data. Thank you.
You're welcome. Are there any other questions?
Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just noticed, Ruby, on yours, there's nobody that turns up in Curry County, and it's not on your list. And it was as I went through the list that Jeff compiled, Curry County's not served, it looks like. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westland, Family Care actually was the Curry County provider. For a long period of time. When DOCS, which is the Coosa County provider, was formed, they did dip in a little to that population, but we had like 90%. What happened in Curry County was that one of the providers in Brookings, we helped the Board of Medical Examiners send them on their way. They had a very large population, but there was a fraud problem. And at that point, then we could not guarantee access for the entire population. We actually asked OMAP if we could do it, if we could exclude the Brookings zip code and continue to serve the rest of the county. And the answer back was no. You have to either serve the whole county or serve nobody. So we exited the county. We could have served it on what they call an open enrollment basis. But just to give you an idea of the numbers, we had 2,200 clients for the whole county. In dropping Brookings, we would have lost about 750. But since the county was open, we would have lost 750, so that would have left us, what my numbers are, about 1,400 clients. But since it was an open enrollment, what happened was is those people, the only people that sign up in an open county are those who are sick. We were down to 450 clients, and every one of them was sick. And as soon as they needed a position, they'd come back onto the plan. That was an adverse risk, so
right.
We had to exit.
Thank you.
Great. Any other questions for Ruby or Jeff? Thanks for being here.
I'd like to introduce Dean Andretta, and he'll speak more. But one of the questions we were asked is to bring sort of a wide variety of how plans were organized. You've got two nonprofits, and then a lot of the plans have been organized by independent physicians, just physician groups in various counties. And Dean represents the group here in Marion Polk County, and he's going to tell you a little bit about how they're organized. We all provide the same services, but a little bit different flavor on you know, who put together the network here in Marion Polk.
Thank you, Jeff. Chair Westland, members of the committee, my name is Dean Andretta, and I am the Chief Financial Officer for the Mid-Valley IPA, and who is the wholly owned, the owner of the Marion Polk Community Health Plan. And I've been in that capacity for about 8 years now, and I appreciate the opportunity. I'm a veritable rookie here, so please be patient with me. I just want to give you a quick overview of our organization. We're located right here in Salem. We were incorporated in 1991 as a mutual benefit corporation. It's a not-for-profit, taxable C corporation. So,
is this the first time you've testified before a legislative committee?
It's the second time.
Oh, dang.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, don't we have some special rituals for first-timers or second-timers?
We can't disclose those now for fear of, excitement. Those who like to come forward.
You're an electric bolt or something.
Mr. Chair, the children are gone, so you can...
Yeah. go ahead, Dean.
Thanks. The membership of our IPA and many of the IPAs across the state, we are 99%, virtually all of the physicians in Marion Polk County, with the exception of Kaiser physicians, are members of our organization. We contract, initially we were set up to provide a contracting for a conduit to the managed care organizations. And so we still currently do that. We contract with 12 or so different plans. And our affiliated company is Marion Polk Community Health Plan. It's an LLC that where the manager is Mid-Valley IPA. So it's really essentially one and the same organization. The ownership of the it's a not-for-profit, so there really isn't there's not shareholders. It's an association plan. So it is run by a board of 16 physicians, and they we rotate presidencies between primary care and specialty, very similar to many of the other IPAs across the state. Our mission statement is to preserve and promote the wise use of health resources in Marion and Polk counties, and to enhance the ability of physicians to act as patient advocates and to assure a sound and ethical business environment that promotes flexibility in the pursuit of appropriate opportunities, like the Oregon Health Plan created. We do a variety of services there for the physicians in our community. We help with recruitment. We contract, of course. We put some group purchasing together for the physicians regarding malpractice insurance and group health insurance and things of that nature. We also have a very extensive wide area network in which we've actually connected each one of our 160 sites and have about 1,500 users in a network that where we conduct business and offer eligibility information and authorization management and get information out onto. We're also their internet service provider and a variety of other things. And then we also have a full complement of the insurance functions because of the Oregon Health Plan to pay claims and do a variety of services there. We focus greatly on medical management services, primarily for Oregon Health Plan, and also for commercial insurance providers. And part of that is just your nuts and bolts, utilization management, concurrent review for inpatients, quality assurance, and quality improvement initiatives. We're responsible for exceptional needs care coordination for those patients that require ENCC and do a lot of complex care coordination and disease management initiatives on a localized basis. To give you a little background on the Marion Polk Community Health Plan, we took over May 2001, and we took over because Regents exited the market, and Regents, for whatever reasons, did get out of the plan. The OMAP and the legislature came to us, not the legislature, I'm sorry, the governor's office and OMAP came to our board and asked us to step up, and we did. And we were probably one of the later entrants in terms of IPAs into the market.
Excuse me, don't let Gordon's phone interrupt you.
Okay, thanks.
He just does that to try to throw you off. That's everybody.
Better than Bates.
Good job.
We'll
good job.
I leave my beef through and I'm gone. And he's right for you.
It doesn't happen in committees.
Yeah.
We do it more than twice a day.
Yeah. We don't have any hospital partners like some of the other physician hospital associations that are fully capitated health plans.
So how do you manage that portion of your cost?
We have a contractual arrangements with Salem Hospital, contractual arrangements with the other hospitals in the more rural areas that we serve. So it's strictly a contractual arrangement to pay them a fee for service when Oregon Health Plan members go there.
And that's negotiated every how long?
They're usually annual contracts. They are annual contracts negotiated each year.
So they then are taking the risk of that.
The contractual arrangement is that if a patient that's on Marion Polk Community Health Plan goes into the hospital, we pay them X amount of money for an emergency room service or an inpatient admission based on the diagnostic-related group. They do have a withhold, what's called a withhold. So we pay them $1,000 for the emergency room visit. Maybe, hopefully not $1,000, but $1,000 for the emergency room visit. We withhold 10% of the money in order to reconcile later on as there's a funding, a budget, and then when the claims expense come in, that determines how much of that withhold is returned. That is the extent in which the hospitals share risk for us. The physicians, on the other hand, there are other financial arrangements with the physicians, but some are in that realm, some are in a capitated realm. So that's really the arrangement of the hospitals. It's fee-for-service with some risk. For tertiary care, there is no risk. It's just a negotiated rate with the legacy facilities or Oregon Health Sciences University.
And these rates are based off the RVUs? I mean, some...
For hospital services, no. It's generally, we try to base it on what OMAP publishes in terms of a payment rate for facilities, for hospitals, or what we can negotiate with them directly. So there are DRG-type hospitals. There are also type A and type B hospitals.
Different rates.
Right. So we're pretty much in lockstep with OMAP in terms of hospital contracting. Some of it's a bit different, but generally speaking, we're trying to as OMAP publishes their hospital services guide, we go ahead and follow that.
We're both going to be insulted now.
I'm not sure, Alan, who should be more, you or me, but probably me or you. You say there's no risk. But if you pay an X, I mean, you're paying X for an emergency room visit, I mean, that there's a range of costs depending upon, I mean, is it categorized by disease or just by the type of service? You know, I mean, somebody comes in with a bad cold to the ER, there's a fixed cost for even presenting there. But if somebody comes in with a heart attack, it's going to probably cost a little bit more for the facility to administer the care.
Yeah. Representative Cruz, Chair Westland, for inpatient services at a DRG hospital, you have one of 500 or so DRGs. There's a DRG for congestive. A DRG is called a diagnostic-related grouping.
Right.
And a diagnostic-related grouping is based on what the diagnosis is and whether that person had complications or not. So, for instance, somebody goes in and has a baby and they have no complications, it's a DRG 372 or 373. If they have a C-section, it's a DRG 371. There are weights associated to each one of those and a conversion factor. You multiply the weight times the conversion factor. So open heart surgery is $20,000. A baby is $1,500.
So basically, you're reimbursing at whatever percent of DRG OMAP says is appropriate, or whatever you can negotiate, but clearly not full.
No.
So it's based on the way your reimbursement, your fee-for-service reimbursement with hospitals is based on the way they conduct their business, whether it's the same with an A and B, I'm assuming.
Representative Cruz, Chair Westland, yes. We negotiate. We do the best that we can to negotiate the near to what OMAP actually produces as the rate in their hospital services guide. The negotiations are separate and distinct from that. Sometimes, you know, in fact, with Salem Hospital, our contract with Salem Hospital does not look like at all what OMAP would pay them. We have negotiated something a little bit different for them, but it is based on DRGs. And so, you know, one hospital contract is one hospital contract. But generally for DRG hospitals, it's a DRG type of rate. For type A and type B hospitals, unless we are, our hands are a little bit tied there because they are not interested in negotiating DRG rates. They are very happy, generally speaking, I should say, with percentage of charges. And when an emergency room person presents from a type B hospital, we pay a percentage of the charge, and it's negotiated or it's associated with what OMAP has given us.
Okay. One final question, Mr. Chair. Why is Kaiser excluded?
Kaiser Physicians, I'm sorry, Chair, Representative.
They have their own IPA or?
Chair Westland, yeah. They are a health plan and an organization that they don't. We're almost a competitor with them. They have their own HMO, their own panel of providers, and we've historically not had any contractual relationship, and nor do they are they a member or ever have been a member of our organization. It's the independent physicians.
Representative Merkley. Type A and Type B hospitals.
Representative Merkley, Chair Cruz. Chair Westland, type A and type B hospitals are based on the OMAP classifies them as either in a rural setting or a bed size limitation. In our particular region, Sania Memorial Hospital and Silverton Hospital, and I believe West Valley Hospital are all what they call type B facilities. So they are reimbursed based on their cost, not on a DRG. Salem Hospital is larger than 50 beds and is based, they're a DRG type hospital.
Do you have any A's?
Not in our area.
Okay, I wouldn't think so.
Mr. Chair and Representative Merkley, the type A and B hospitals are actually statutorily created, and the payment methodology is also in statute. So it is required that we pay them a percentage of bill charges. OMAP uses a number of factors, including some federal calculations, to determine what percent of bill charges we have to pay for services in every single hospital. So what we have, when he talks about the published list, we actually have every hospital in the state. And for the A's and B's, it'll say you have to pay X percent for inpatient and X percent for outpatient. And sometimes, depending on the hospital, it could be 76% or 97% or 20%. On the DRG hospitals, you have a DRG number, a conversion number, that you just times by the number of units for inpatient. And then for outpatient, it's a percentage of charges, again, factored the same way that they do for the A's and B's. But for the A's and B's, Dean is correct. There's very little negotiation because basically the state's told us what we have to pay for them.
Do you have any emergency access hospitals? Emergency access hospitals. It's a new Medicaid category, what, about 4 years ago?
Critical access.
No, we don't.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In order to attempt to control hospital costs, which are the driving cost factors now probably mean more than pharmaceuticals. Do you have anything in place to help control that cost? Do you audit the bills you get to make sure they're appropriate for the disease? Audit the bills coming in from ER visits? In order to get to an ER, does a patient have to check with the triage nurse or check with a physician first before they go in? Are you giving those kind of things in place?
Representative Bates, Chair Westland, we do. We really, part of this, in managing this population, you asked a question earlier about kind of the commercial health plans. Why did they get out? Why weren't they not successful? And they tried to, an Oregon Health Plan member was a commercial member. It just was in their pipeline. It wasn't really a distinct business in terms of their whole medical management strategy. Emergency room is extremely key. If we get an emergency room claim in, every single one of them are looked at. If it's in the middle of the day, and the physician was open, and the physician did not send them there, essentially the claim is denied for it's not medically necessary. It was not an appropriate medical setting, and the patient is responsible for that if there's appropriate waivers in place at the hospital. Just to give you an idea, is prior when it was with Regents, they reviewed of their emergency room issues. About 9% of the claims that came in were denied for not medically necessary, and in terms of the percentages. 2.35% of all the emergency room visits were actually denied by Regents for a variety of issues. Once we took it over, it's actually 13% now. It's the same population. We just inherited it from Regents. And 69% of that 13% is denied for not medically necessary. We have to educate these patients to not go to the emergency room for their primary care. And so emergency room is the first thing. I mean, it is the number one thing that we look at. Generic usage or non-generic usage, brand usage on prescription drugs is looked at very heavily. Inpatient admissions are looked at very heavily. Transfers, all of those things are looked at very, very closely. We have, this is a much different type of management structure than we have than what Regents had because it's out of necessity, out of being able to survive financially, you have to do it. And we have made significant strides in identifying the people who are habitually showing up at the emergency room and getting them on care plans, getting them to one pharmacy so they can't drug seek, to do a number of things that prevent that usage and stop it. And our emergency room utilization has decreased over the last quarters, every quarter, that's primarily, I think, a major difference between when Regents had it and when we had it.
Can you say that again in fewer words?
I'm sorry.
Fewer syllables. I mean, for me, what you just said that's the crux of what's important, and I want to make sure the committee gets that. Can you say that again in a more succinct way? Maybe you can.
Chair Westland, the medical management of this population requires significant efforts to look at emergency room usage. That is the number one abuse and poor setting and costly setting to have your membership go to. And so as we took over this population, we virtually, the denial rate for medical necessity went from 2% prior to Regents to 13% after we took it over. Of that 13%, 70% of the 13% denial rate, 70% of that 13% is denied because it is not appropriate medical setting. And that savings, the savings generated by that, which I didn't add, is about $1.4 million a year for us, and just in the emergency room alone.
So, and I don't know if this is your question, But, I mean, what did you do to drive that rate, if you will, that denial rate? And
okay, we require every single emergency room claim to have chart notes. The chart notes are reviewed. We follow up with the primary care physician to find out what time was the emergency room utilized, if it was in the middle of the day or on a weekend where there was an urgent care facility or the physician was open and the physician did not direct that person to the emergency room, that is an inappropriate use of emergency room service. And we then get involved with that patient to hook them up with their primary care physician and say, this is the appropriate setting. You can go to your primary care physician during the middle of the day, and they will work you in for the sniffles or for a cold. You know, the other issues that are looked at is, why are they there? And if it's for the sniffles or for a cold or if it's for not an emergent service, again, our ENCC nurses and get involved with that patient, identify the habitual users, and try to change their behavior.
Mr. Chair?
It wasn't sure.
So,
sorry.
Jeff up next. So how much of that 13% actually received treatment? You denied the claim, but how much of that 13% received treatment?
Okay.
This off the top of your head.
Yeah. Of the 13% that were denied, about 10% of that 13% was denied because of the emergency room. The other 3% were denials for pre-authorized issues, pre-authorizations that never occurred. So 10% of the 13%, they actually went to the emergency room and services were provided. And the denial to the hospital for those services is not a contractual write-off. It is a member responsibility because it's not medically necessary or part of the benefit plan. So with a waiver, the hospitals can then collect that from the patient, and we hope that they do so that we can educate that patient and that patient has some skin in the game to know that that is not an appropriate use of emergency room services.
But, I mean, obviously begs the question. I mean, these are health plan patients. We're not talking about folks with a lot of discretionary cash, and my concern there is how much of that gets shifted to commercial, private pay.
Chair Weston, that is the hospital's really gripe in this whole matter. We have done our best to work with the hospitals and the emergency room physicians to help lower the emergency room usage. But if it's not part of the benefit plan or part of the capitation, we cannot afford to pay it and continue to exist.
Right, and then I wonder how much of that comes back on you in these contract negotiations that you do annually.
It all comes around.
And who's really paying here? They're not here to micromanage your business.
Right.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you've touched on my question, which was related to whether the patient is then asked to pay if when you turn down the hospital. Because from a patient point of view, it's important for them to know at the time of service whether they're covered or not, in a sense. I say this as a parent who has taken my small children into the emergency room after having called up the advice line for our plan with Providence and described the situation and had the nurse say, well, we're not sure. Maybe you should bring them in. Maybe you shouldn't. Yeah, we think you should bring them in. I bring them in not knowing for sure whether this inner ear infection or whatever the heck it is something that merits that. But to what degree, I mean, if the patient is not really told, is not really told by the hospital, this is appropriate or this isn't, how fair is it to go back and try to collect from the patient?
Representative Merkley, Chair Westland, first of all, we do, before any denial is made, we find out, did the PCP advise this person to go there? If that was advice, their advice, absolutely the claim is paid. If there is a whole list of criteria, which if that person went to the emergency room with an open wound, with heart palpitations, with all kinds of other issues, there's no questions asked. These are, we ask the question to the primary care physician. They were open. Did the PCP direct them there? And then, if not, we go ahead and die. In terms of the hospital, in order for the physician, the hospital to collect from the patient, they have to have a signed waiver specific for that visit, and they cannot certainly turn them away. They have to provide an appropriate screening exam, and so the hospitals do provide that service. And if they're going to collect from the patient, they've got to have an appropriate waiver in that place. Many of the hospitals have not gone that direction because of EMTALA law. I don't know if you've heard that, but they cannot turn people away from the emergency room.
If I may, Mr. Chair and Representative Merkley, the federal requirements for hospitals is any patient that presents, they have to do an evaluation and stabilization of the patient. And so that's required. What is also required on the plans is we generally have to pay for that portion. Mm-hmm. Where the utilization review comes in is after that evaluation has taken place and the stabilization. And most of the cases that we all deny are the cases where there was no need for a visit in the first place. In other words, they come with a bee sting times 6 days kind of thing, and that's an actual example. So we end up having to pay for the triage because the hospital is required to do that. But beyond that point, then that's where we stop payment, and we would hope, and in some cases it works, in some cases it doesn't, that the hospital ERs would say to the patient, look, you don't need to be here based on our medical evaluation. Where you need to be is in your primary care office, and we're going to send you back. But if you want to have services here, here's the bill that you get to pay before we start.
Yeah, that would be ideal.
Now, that's the ideal situation. I've got one hospital that will do that, and the rest of them basically are not.
Hmm. Thank you.
Kindly will throw in there. Well, yeah, that's a longer discussion.
Yes. That is correct. We always pay for the initial screening of the patient. We don't. And from that point forward, the claim is denied.
I was next.
Oh,
Chair.
I see that on my note here. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm still following up on the question that the Chair asked and that Representative Merkley asked. So if the patient does go to the hospital inappropriately for bee sting or whatever, and they've been advised what their bill would be, but as the Chair was saying, these are low-income folks who probably cannot pay for that expense. So then does the hospital absorb that expense, or does that go to the other insurance companies?
Mr. Chair, Representative told me, it depends on whether the hospital decides to provide the services. And that really is a decision point that's pretty important here, because if the hospital decides to go ahead and provide non-emergency services and the patient, you know, wants them, then basically that goes into the hospital cost bucket,
okay,
and it gets passed on to some other payer,
right,
because we will not pay for that. But we need to make the point really clear is that both the patient and the hospital have made the choice there,
right,
that those services are going to be provided knowing what the criteria are and that it won't be paid for.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I think I heard you say that they go and are paid for one time if they make the mistake to go directly to the hospital. You pay for the first time, but then you do an exit survey essentially to see when they went, whether they were emergency, needed emergency services, and you then work with the patient to steer them away from doing it again?
Representative Anderson, Chair Westland, yes, we identify. Each emergency room visit is separate and distinct. I mean, we're going to look at each one of those instances. However, over the course of time, we will identify patients who habitually use the emergency room in inappropriate ways and connect with those patients, get care plans set up, have them sign those care plans, do a number of things to coordinate and hook them up with their primary care physician and other areas. I kind of wanted to run through the goals of what Marion Polk.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple. This is Bates. Yes, Cruz over there.
Yeah.
It makes the assumption that he can read, and I believe it, but. Yeah. You're going to have to make that up.
A couple of issues here that I think need to be fleshed out just real quickly. What you're trying to do in your program, and correct me if I'm wrong, is educate two different groups. One, the patient, not to go there. When the patient goes there with something trivial, gets a screening exam and is told it's trivial and sent home, they are not likely to go back again. Okay? That's because they've been educated. When the hospital doesn't get paid, when they go ahead and see a patient that they shouldn't have seen, then they get educated or more likely to tell the patient what the scoop is. Our ERs are being jammed at times by people on OHP who should not be there, and you and I would never think of going in with. And you know that, and I know that, and let's just face up to it, okay? When we had managed care in my county, which we have some of through Care Oregon, but not complete managed care, we found that our utilization of emergency rooms dropped like a rock after a couple of months. These people quickly learned, the hospital quickly learned that they weren't going to be paid for this. We weren't going to... Let's just say we weren't going to enable I'm careful what I'm saying, or facilitate bad behaviors, okay? Mm-hmm. Has your experience been that as you put this program in, you can pair where you were with a commercial product, then we went to your tightly managed care product that you started denying claims. Have you seen a drop in usage of ER as a result of that, which is where we really want to go? Have you seen that program work? So that you're not just doing a cost shift in the hospital, you're actually changing people's behaviors, the hospital's behavior and the patient's behavior. Have you seen that change?
Yeah, Representative Bates, Chair Westland, since we took the plan over, emergency room usage has dropped 20%.
That's my
And it has made the difference probably between being able to survive and not. That in conjunction with prescription drugs.
So we're not talking about a cost shift here. We're talking about people changing the behavior so they're being seen the most efficient way possible.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Hold on, Dean.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
What further reduction of that do you think is possible? Another 3%, another 10%, another 20%?
Representative Anderson, Chair Westland, I think that there's still definitely room. Patients come on and off the plan frequently, and I think there's even better results. I think that we could probably reduce it up to 50%. The one in four emergency room claims right now are extremely questionable. They should be there, and it's more like 50% of them are probably not the best setting to have them there. So I think we have a long, long way to go still. But in fact, we have a great dialogue going on with Salem Hospital now that they are in pretty much agreement that this is not appropriate. The emergency room physicians do not want to have this in there. They want to be emergency room physicians. They don't want to be primary care physicians in the emergency room. So, there's still ways to go.
Mr. Chair.
Let me point out that Dean is 3.5 slides into a 7.2 slide presentation.
Yeah, I will be.
And I know he's thrilled to stay here, second time testifying and all.
Yeah, it's great.
I'll note that Representative Bates, that I want to follow up on this emergency room question with you to understand better why we don't have mechanisms at the emergency room to control this use. That what's preventing us from being there?
I'll tell you why later.
Please proceed if
sir. Okay, thank you. The goals of our plan when we created it was to enhance access to physician care for both specialty and primary care, for patients, to enhance access for patients, to reduce administrative costs, to provide as much money as possible on direct patient care, and have enough funds to meet the contractual solvency and net worth requirements that are illustrated in our contract with OMAP. We don't have any other profit motive. We are not for profit. The monies that we have are are spent on physician care, on, you know, we are a physician-directed organization that is here for the benefit of the doctors. So to the degree there's dollars there, they go out to the membership. So we have eliminated the need to make a profit that's other than what's required contractually by OMAP.
Dean, what page are we on? I mean, my sheets are so old.
I'm sorry, it's slide 6 on page 3.
There we go.
Demographics, just to give you a quick idea on Marion Polk County.
Next page.
Page 7 and 8. Page 8, we've gone from about 40,000 members in 2000 to about 50,000 members for the entire Oregon Health Plan population in Marion Polk County, not Marion Polk. The next slide shows the current breakdown. Slide number 9, we have Marion Polk has about 29,000 patients. Kaiser has 2,500 patients in our area. Care Oregon's got about 5,000.
Hey, don't rush. We were taking your time. Okay. You take your time.
Okay.
Feel free to rush.
And
you're the one that asked.
I have Valentine's
Day. I'm going to ask some questions.
And about 12,000 or so that are not with a managed care plan. In terms of the standard and plus populations, which you've heard, actually for our population, it's 19% standard and 81% plus. To give you an idea of our patient mix and our revenue mix.
Are you guys dropping out March 1st of the standard?
Yes, we are.
Do you know of anyone who's not?
I have heard a couple people are going to stay in at least for a couple months.
Okay.
60% of the patients are on are children. 11% are the dual eligible folks. 8% are blind and disabled without Medicare. 19% again of the adults in the expansion population, and 2% are pregnant. That's in terms of the patient mix. In terms of the revenue, 60% of the kids generate 33% of the revenue. 18% of the revenue is generated by the Medicare Medicaid population. 11% of the patients. 7% of the money is from pregnant and only 2% of the population. So gives you kind of an idea of the revenue mix. When we looked at the standard plan, 42% of the people are in the 0 to 10% of the federal poverty level, very similar to the entire state. I had some numbers there on our funding, our per member per month. Since October, it has changed four times. In October, our blended per member per month for everything was $207. It went up to $280 when the decision was made to increase OB reimbursement. From there, it went down to $203.61 when OHP2 came up. And March 2003, it looks like $192, though. That's changed, I guess. That's assuming that plus and standard was put together.
Mr. Chair, I'm afraid I got lost on this last slide. What is that telling us again?
Slide 14?
Yes.
Slide 14 tells you, I'm sorry, Representative Motus Anderson, Chair Westland.
Good, he learns quick.
I was coached beforehand. In October of 2002, the per member per month, per member per month that we get, so multiply that times 30,000, and that's how much revenue we got. It was $207. And March 2003, after prescription drugs and everything else goes away, it's $192.94. And I think that's changing a bit as we speak, but that's generally what has occurred.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
What happens to the 19% of your members on March 1st who are part of the standard plan?
Representative Merkley, Chair Westland, I can't tell you exactly what will happen other than that we will stay as involved as we possibly can to ensure that those people have access. They will go into open card, which means that OMAP will be the primary payer and not Marion Polk Community Health Plan. So then at that point, we cannot guarantee access to those patients. So it will be up to the individual physicians in our group on how they deal with the Medicaid population directly. So
they essentially leave managed care and become per expense clients. They're still paying their premium. They're still paying their copay. They're still members of the Oregon Health Plan. but they've got to find somebody willing to take them.
Correct.
And, or worse, they just don't have such trouble finding someone to take them. They wait until they're really sick, present to the emergency room.
Real expensive.
Yeah.
And there's one more issue here. They don't have pharmaceutical coverage.
Right.
They don't have pharmaceutical coverage.
And that's ending
March.
When?
March 1st.
March 1st. And that's why you're bailing March 1st. Back to the comment made about
the drop off too.
And we passed that in the last session, or that was part of the e-board?
E-board decision.
That was the e-board decision. So that's just kind of reverberating through the whole system.
Measure 28.
Measure 28. So this is
Measure 28. House Bill
5100. I'm sorry. 5100.
Okay, it wasn't e-board. All right.
Yeah.
All right.
I'd like to jump ahead maybe to slide 17, because I think this illustrates why most of the plans are getting out of the standard population. When we take the capitation in, there are buckets in which the dollars are funded by physician, hospital, pharmaceutical, etc. 26% of the revenue that we get from OMAP comes from is allocated for physician services. 29.4% is for hospital services. 29% is for prescription drugs. 7.6 is other, which is chemical dependency, DME, vision benefit, etc.
Durable medical equipment.
Yeah, sorry, durable medical equipment. And the other 8% is for administrative expenses. We actually spend 31.8% of our dollars on physician services. We spend 37.4% on hospital services, and we only spend 16% of our dollars on prescription drugs, because we have 80% of our prescriptions are generic, and we have done the physicians in our community have done a tremendous job of controlling prescription drug utilization. They have embraced a very rigid formulary that we have. They have driven that. They have it's their own. We have step therapy programs. We have a lot of the really expensive drugs that there are alternatives for. We've moved people into methadone instead of OxyContin and things of that nature, and saved a lot of money. That money is used to pay the hospitals and the physicians to get this access that we have. And the profit that we can make on the plan is what we can do, you know, if we can administer this less than 8%. That's what we're trying to have as terms of profit in order to meet the solvency requirements. And so, kind of in summary, before MIPCHIP took over the plan, the administrative costs at the commercial health insurances were 20 or 30% higher than what we can do it for. The claims expense exceeded the funding. The two commercial health plans lost a combined $6 million on just the population here in Marion and Polk County. That's why they got out. And over 40% of the patients on one plan didn't have a PCP. Today, we can get a person a PCP. If they don't have one today, we can get them one. We have access. The reason we have access is because the physicians have agreed to participate. They've agreed to participate because they're part of an organization that they are owned by, or that they are owners of, and they have a vested interest in. We also have other options. We provide some benefits to them to be part of our organization as well, in terms of the commercial contracts and just the advocacy that we can provide for them. So I think that what you're going to see, and I hope that you look closely at, is as the standard population come in March, look at the access. That is the thing that local provider, the local community-based plans can bring is this access, and we have proven that. And without it, you're gonna see what the effects of that are gonna be as people, as the standard population gets into the open card situation. In the Oregon Health Plan, it's metamorphosized into. OMAP has a direct relationship in most of all the communities with the physicians, with the providers. It is the holy grail that is needed for any healthcare organization to survive. Any OMAP is essentially a payer, and they have that relationship with community-owned local providers who know the community, who know how to get resources. We have partnered with the mental health providers, the chemical dependency providers, the county health departments, and all of the physicians in the community. And so we cannot, consider the model, consider the infrastructure that has developed because of the Oregon Health Plan and it's going into a community-based, provider-owned, whether it's hospital providers, hospital physician, or physician-owned organizations that allow us to have that direct relationship and allow us to deal with the issues that we can to ensure that patients have access and go from there.
Mr. Chair.
Well, the primary care physicians in your, quote, market area participate in the plan?
100%.
What about subspecialists?
100%.
Every physician, is it Marion and Polk counties?
Every independent physician, with the exception of Kaiser, participates in the Marion Polk Community Health Plan. 100%.
Pretty good.
It's standard.
Representative Murphy.
We touched on the emergency rooms as a major issue. Now we're talking about kind of drug coverage and how that's driving the changes here. Have you talked about other solutions that might be implemented, such as letting people pay a prescription premium into the plan, or anything that might enable this to still work? So on and so forth. I mean, it's a big deal. Here you are. You have a mission. You have your nonprofit. You're trying to provide access to care, and a group of people are now going to have a much harder time accessing care. So how was there a lot of brainstorming, and you just hit a lot of dead ends before you decided to drop these patients? Or
Representative Merkley, Chair Westland, we ran through. I mean, this has been metamorphosizing pretty quickly, and so over the last week we have gone through several financial scenarios, and every scenario that we have come up with in looking at our costs and looking at the costs of the standard population and then eliminating the drug prescription drug benefit produced financial results that we could not survive. We would not be able to survive the whole thing. But that having said, we are not wanting to abandon the patients. So those patients now do have a PCP, but we cannot guarantee that because we don't require participation under a Medicaid. So we are doing whatever we can to come up with the best pricing for prescription drugs throughout our county. To provide that list to these patients, to identify the people with chronic diseases now that are on multiple medications, to ensure that they are managed before they go off the plan, and attempt to work with their PCP so that they aren't taken away. I mean, we're going to do whatever we can, but it's just metamorphosized so quickly that we have really tried to.
And this now becomes a major issue for us to wrestle with. And this is separate from the medically needy funding that we had in the bill the other day. Okay.
Yeah. Are you working with the large drug manufacturers on their free prescription programs?
Yes. Yeah, we're putting a website and information together so that we can hook people into that. I've talked to our primary care, a large portion of our primary care base, and they're all aware of it. So we will do our best to get people hooked into those programs.
You've got 100% of the physicians. What percent of your eligibles are covered?
What percentage of the in
Marion Polk counties
in terms of how many have cover, how many are uninsured?
You've got X amount that are eligible. That's 100%.
30,000.
That tells me a number. What's the percent? How many are eligible in your area? I'm trying to
gauge. Oh, I'm sorry. 50,000. There's.
Yeah. Of those that are eligible to be enrolled in your plan, how many are truly enrolled?
Percentage.
Okay.
You can give me numbers. We can do the percent.
30,000 of our patients are on our plan. There are in our county. There are 12,000 open card patients. So, 12,000 out of 50,000 people are on open card right now.
That's
fairly standard in
that's in both counties.
In both Marion and Polk County.
Yeah, it's just amazing that in this one little town of Kaiser, they don't have any physicians. I mean, that just kills me.
Nobody gets sick there.
That's why Backlund's in such good shape.
And everybody's above average.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that concerns me about this entire milieu we're in is groups like Kaiser are completely walking away. Even with the great program you've run, I'm going to guess that physicians are taking a lower fee for seeing your patients than you are for commercial patients. Those commercial patients are paying a higher fee than they should because of that cost shift. I would expect the hospitals in the same position. So when a group like Kaiser pulls out, they get only the commercial rate, which is a result of a cost shift,
mm-hmm.
or they can sell their product cheaper because they're not taking on the fair burden inside the community. So is my assessment of that correct or is that incorrect?
Representative Bates, Chair Westland, it is. I've received several very concerned calls from physicians, but
stall while you're trying to come up with an answer.
Kaiser has a very small presence in Marion and Polk County with the Oregon Health Plan, but there is a concern that in the marketplace that there's 2,700 patients that they have that are no longer going to be there, and they will fill those up with potentially commercial insurance, commercially insured patients that may not have otherwise selected Kaiser before a premium, as the premium increases are out there. So that is very true. It has opened up some access for them and a potential for them to go ahead and price their products at more competitive rates. So I know there's concerns with the physicians in our area about that.
And also, let the record show that before the witness answered the question, he had a wry smile on his face.
It's not a planted question.
I do also want to address just to give you an idea of the differential in the cost. I mean, the physicians are not getting rich here. We pay an average conversion factor of $30 per member per month, or $30 for what they call RBRBS conversion factor. Commercial insurances are double that. Medicare in privatized situation is also significantly higher than that. So, we are working here on the good graces of many of the physicians as well, and they have all stepped to the plate. And I think that in large part they've stepped to the plate because we've offered them say and offered them governance and offered them to get input on how best to care for the population. So,
sure.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. First of all, you have 100% of the physicians covered, and there is a reserve that they've contributed to.
Representative Anderson, Chair Westland, we are association. Some of the IPAs are actually for-profit and have sold shares. So essentially, to belong to our organization, doctors pay $300 a year. That's it. They did not have to pony up dollars for us to be part of the Oregon Health Plan, to do Oregon Health Plan. We had some reserves initially, the IPA, before Oregon Health Plan, that the IPA put in to secure the initial solvency requirement, and since then have been really forced to make a profit on the Oregon Health Plan in order to meet the solvency requirements. And so we have met our solvency requirements and are compliant with that through the operation of the health plan.
So you're putting in $300 in order to either break even or lose a little.
The $300 are just for the dues that the physicians pay to belong. The other thing is that we created some bylaws. I mean, not every doctor came willingly, but in our bylaws that indicates that if you want to be a member of the Mid-Valley IPA, you must be participative in Marion Polk Community Health Plan. And doctors can close their practice, no problem. If they're full, they're full, and they can close, so we can't assign patients to them. But they are participative for the patients that they see, and the specialists that they the specialists all participate as well.
Second question is, if it looks like you're subsidizing the rest of your care by the pharmacy prescription, do you expect that to continue, or is the pharmacy cost going up so radically?
Representative Anderson, Chair Westland. I think that I'm sure that it will get tighter and tighter, and that was specifically the reason why we actually decided not to participate in standard, is because there without the prescription drug benefit on the standard plan and that cushion, not only the drugs themselves to give the physicians some ability to control costs, but by that cushion we would it was enough to make us so that we wouldn't be able to meet our solvency requirements.
Well, you can't manage your population
right
at the end of the day. And Gordon, we don't want to explain this to you too soon, but that $300 you have to contribute to an organization to almost break even, that's a heck of a lot better deal than you got as a legislator. But, you know, we don't want you to learn that too quick.
You do know about the $300 you have to pay me to belong, right?
Right. Representative Cruz, per member.
Yeah.
If primary care reimbursement rates were raised 15%, what would that do to the number of open card folks? Would it decrease significantly? Speculate. I'm not tying you to this.
Representative Cruz, Chair Westland, did you say 15 or 50?
15. I'm being overly optimistic in a kind of a realistic sort of way.
Well, my estimation on it is that it's not just a financial situation. It is a capacity. I mean, we have a tough time recruiting. We have a tough time bringing new docs to town, and you know, given the liability environment and some of the other things, we've just had a tough time. So generally, most of the docs are pretty full at the brim. If it increased 15%, what would help is the lion's share. You know, 20% of the physicians, primary care physicians, represent or have 80% of the docs. It would significantly help those folks out, and potentially would allow us to recruit doctors to go into those clinics that serve them. So it would certainly help. I can't tell you how much it would help, but I think it would.
One final question: Are you experiencing an OB crisis at the current time?
Representative Cruz, Chair Westland, we were, but right. Actually, a few months ago, we actually were successful and recruited three or four more OBs to town. And one of the main OBs in town did get the malpractice situation squared away that she had. So we are not experiencing an OB crisis right now. We have enough OBs in town to take care of the deliveries at this point. So that was really timely that we were able to recruit three or four more, not 4 or 5 months ago.
Representative Bates, maybe we could take a couple of them down south with us.
Yeah. How'd she resolve her malpractice situation?
Mr. Chair?
You know, I just want to point out that even though Jeff did stumble over that 15 versus 50, you know how I knew it was 15? Because if he said 50, you'd be on the floor and Bates would be giving you CPR.
Jeff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I think we need to make a distinction when you ask the question about the 15%. If the managed care plans raised their rates 15%, I think we'd all be very fat and happy if we had the ability to do that. If you raise just the fee-for-service payments that OMAP puts out for their stuff, you will not get a great influx of access for this population. And the reason why, you go back to my second page, is because these patients are very difficult, and the doctors you know, rely on a lot of other services that we provide. So what we pose the question to some of our docs is, what would happen if we just, you know, leave the standard population? And they said, we won't see them because we won't have the support.
Right, and yeah, and that was the assumption behind it, was if that is raised, do more of the open card folks come in into that closed system? I mean, you know, clearly, I don't think we necessarily. I don't know how we solve that reimbursement problem. But we need to work on the one that we can deal with at this point.
Any other questions? You guys did great. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Yeah, and we're sure that's all your fault. Now, Dean, just so you don't learn bad habits from Jeff and Ruby, mm-hmm. when you're testifying in front of your third committee, mm-hmm. everything goes through the chair. It's not Representative Cruz, Chair Westland. It's Chair Westland, Representative Cruz.
All right. Actually, you two could learn something from him.
Yeah. I did. Seeing no other business to come before the committee,
but
we are
your
adjourned.
Your typewriter doesn't know how to spell Marion.